From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. A new report from the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Learning suggests while there may be problems with the standard Carnegie unit or credit hour widely used across all sectors of education, no better standard has yet to emerge. And part-time faculty across the country debate the merits of a national walkout on February 25th, a day without adjuncts. Hi, I'm Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these discussions on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment this morning, we will revisit the Carnegie Unit. Developed in 1906 as a metric for qualifying teachers and faculty for pensions, the 108-year-old Carnegie Unit is the coin of the realm across American education. It is the standard used by high schools and colleges to measure and award credit for academic work. Moreover, the number of credits, essentially Carnegie units, that a college student takes each term is a critical metric for assessing his or her eligibility for federal financial aid programs. Yet higher education is very different now than it was in 1906, let alone in 1956 or 1986. A small but growing number of students enter college with, quote, credits and high school diplomas earned through homeschooling experiences. The roughly 5.5 million college students ages 17 to 67 enrolled in online courses currently accounts for about a fourth of the total enrollment in post-secondary education in the United States. And competency-based courses and degrees are moving from new institutions such as Western Governors University to traditional universities such as Purdue, Michigan, and Wisconsin. As these changes in higher education continue, the Carnegie Unit remains universally used but is not always universally loved. Quoting from the lead sentence of the story that appeared in Inside Higher Ed yesterday about the report, the foundation seems to conclude, in essence, that, quote, while the credit hour is an inadequate unit for measuring student learning, no better replacement for higher education's gold standard has emerged, and getting rid of it right now would be risky. Joining us for the conversation about the future of the Carnegie Unit is Alana Silver, Senior Associate for Public Policy and Engagement at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching and co-author of the new report titled The Carnegie Unit. Johan Neem is a professor of history at Western Washington University, and Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Alana, let me begin with you. How and why has the Carnegie Unit survived? When first proposed in 1906, it was intended as a metric to help faculty qualify for pensions, not measure teaching time or learning outcomes. And moreover, by 1938, the then president of the foundation characterized the, quote, the system of units and credits as not good enough for American education today. Yet the Carnegie Unit survives and thrives even as the context of the learning and teaching experience has changed dramatically. Alana, help us understand the survival and the fact that the unit still thrives. If you would.
Sure, sure. That's true. It was developed for the purpose of a pension system and really had nothing to do with measuring the quality of learning. It was never intended to do that, and it never has been intended to do that. It is at the center now of a debate about how we should improve the measurement of student learning and how we should improve the designs that we have in education. But it really wasn't about learning. And so part of what we try to do in this report is pull that out and show that it's not intended to be a measure of learning. It is a unit of exposure of time. It's very valuable. It was then and continues to be as an administrative tool in the system. It is essentially the only common currency that we have. It enables us to track, manage, even just see what's happening in the system. And so when you see it from a system level, it continues to be a really very important instrument.
Johan, you have an opinion piece today in Inside Higher Ed talking about the unit and why it should survive. You take a walk through the landscape of alternative metrics, but you also come down very clearly at the beginning and end of your opinion piece that in one sense, the Carnegie Unit is also good for faculty. It kind of protects and defends faculty in terms of faculty interaction as opposed to some other ways of engagement and learning opportunities.
Yes, that's right. I want to be clear. What I was arguing in that piece was not we need to always have the Carnegie Unit, but we need to think about what are the good things it does that we should hold on to in moving forward in the future. And one of the good things it did was provide a way to think about how to compensate faculty for their time. And 100 years ago, as the report makes very clear, there was a crisis for faculty, and Carnegie and others wanted to find a way to ensure that faculty members could have some economic security, and that is an issue that is pressing today. And so, given that some of the models we're seeing beyond the Carnegie unit are models that fundamentally change faculty roles, or in some cases, like Western governors, do away with faculty altogether, I think the health of the academy requires us to think about how do we make sure that faculty are well compensated and are given the academic freedom to perform their public roles.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed. Let me come back to the lead sentence in yesterday's article about the report that, quote, the credit hour is an inadequate unit for measuring student learning. No better replacement for higher education's gold standard exists. It was a fairly long and informative piece yesterday's Inside Higher Ed. What's the risk of getting rid of the Carnegie unit?
Well, you know, the report reminded me in some ways of a report that the American Council on Education issued on accreditation 2 years ago, and they said, yes, there's lots of problems with accreditation, but we don't have a better way, so don't kill it before you know what you're going to replace it with. And I think that's the issue here, is that while competency-based education is definitely taking off in a number of institutions, the vast majority of students aren't currently seeking competency education, or if they are, they're not enrolling in it. And you do need some basic way to count and organize courses into degrees, into, you know, semesters and so forth. And so, you know, that's the problem with a lot of education issues, is it's much easier to point out the imperfections, of which it seems like there are many that people agree on, than to replace it with something. And with students' investment, with taxpayers' investment, you can't just say, hey, let's experiment.
Alana Silver from the Carnegie Foundation. So drawing on Scott's comments a moment ago, I mean, in one sense, you could almost argue that the unit survives whatever its imperfections in a changing landscape, in part because of an absence of a consensus about what might replace us. There may be a lot of agreement that there are some shortcomings, but yet no one has come forward or with a better alternative for dealing with counting credits in one sense, or an alternative to credits. Is that fair?
Well, sure. But again, I'd like to point out that there are two issues here. One is how we administer a system like this, how we count and how we organize, as Scott said. For that, the Carnegie unit is very useful. It will continue to be useful. We all use time in our lives, right? I mean, we may not like it. We may want more hours or to use time better, but we still use it. It's a very functional, simple, logical tool that carries across a vast diversity of systems, education and otherwise. That's one issue. The other issue, and this is really what much of the competency-based education and other designs and other pushes is about, is how you measure learning. And the bottom line is the Carnegie unit wasn't developed to measure learning. So our argument is not that the Carnegie unit is the best measure of learning. It never was, and it isn't, and it won't be. We should, in fact, develop better measures of learning. It's simply that the Carnegie unit isn't getting in the way of developing those other better measures of learning.
But Alana, let me come back to the notion of better measures of learning. In the executive summary of the report, there's a very clear statement on the part of you and your co-authors that says that the unit serves as, quote, a valuable opportunity to learn standard for students in both higher education and K-12 education, where inequitable resources and variable quality are more the rule than the exception. If it's not a measure of learning, how does it serve as a valuable opportunity to learn standard?
It is in this case, and I would say that is far more true for K-12. So that parenthetical part at the end about inequitable resources and variable quality, while true for higher education, is very true and very evident in K-12. And that there is an issue of protecting students, and certainly an equity issue for students in K-12. The issue there is that we should have a bottom line guarantee, an opportunity, a resource opportunity, an input opportunity for those students. That doesn't make the Carnegie unit a measure of learning. It just makes it a resource that is of use. Time is a resource to all of us.
And Scott Jasek, how large is the federal role in all this, given that the Carnegie unit or the credit unit is essential for eligibility for student participation in federal financial aid programs?
Well, I mean, it is the federal rule is frequently cited as a reason to change the Carnegie unit, with people saying, oh, we can't create competency-based programs. Now, in fact, some colleges have applied and received permission to do direct assessment, although many others prefer, even if they're using competency, to link the competency programs to the credit unit. Anyone who's doing new things faces some risks, including being hit with less than sympathetic regulators. But I thought a key part of the report was saying, hey, you people who want to innovate, you actually can do so now. And so that it is in fact possible, and we see evidence of this in current competency programs, to have competency programs that are not attached to the traditional times of Carnegie units.
Johan Neem, your article, your opinion piece this morning at Inside Higher Ed about the Carnegie unit really does wander the landscape of alternative metrics and measures. And obviously what casts a shadow over the conversation, of course, is the issue of quality and competency. Talk a little bit about some of these alternative measures and, you know, are they promising? Do they offer potential? And how should we view them in the context of the larger conversation of the metric that the Carnegie unit provides?
Well, thank you. Yes. So first, I agree with Elena that the Carnegie unit is a measure of time. And I would add time and access to knowledge and insight, right? And so a lot of these alternatives, you asked earlier, what is at risk? One of the things that's at risk is who gets an opportunity to get high quality intellectual experiences. And one of the things I worry about is with some of these alternatives, will we be increasing inequality between the haves and the have-nots in higher education, even as we increase the number of college degrees? In other words, are we actually providing access? That said, I think that there's no reason that the Carnegie unit credit hour is the only way to measure what we do. I think that there should be ways in which we assess how effective our teaching is, how well our students are learning, what our students are learning. There may or may not be a consensus, but of course in the past there have been consensus, you know, about different things. We have had curricula that look very similar across campuses. It's not that that's something that's impossible to achieve. So I don't think it's one or the other. I think we need to think about how to move forward and improve student learning while also recognizing the Carnegie unit's important role in ensuring access to high quality intellectual experiences for all students, not just for the privileged.
But Johan, as I look at the places that have moved towards alternative metrics, Western Governors University, and we've had, for example, Aaron Brower on this program talking about the competency movement underway at the University of Wisconsin, those folks would argue that, in fact, their effort towards competency, in fact, expands access for individuals who in the past might not have been able to get into higher education or higher education as it had been offered under more conventional and traditional metrics.
No, that is certainly what they argue. I don't think that's in fact the case. And let me explain that for a minute. I think that the first thing we have to recognize in our society is that college is a particular kind of experience, and it's not for everyone, and that has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with inclinations, aspirations. There's something wrong in our society when the only way we can imagine people being rewarded for their intelligence and work is by getting a college degree. So we put people in these contexts where they have to get a degree no matter what they do, and then places like WGU come along and say, well, we're going to give you a fast and easy degree, and I find that disrespectful to both the students involved and to the meaning and purpose of college education, which is only one type of education in our society, not the only type.
Scott, would Western Governors think that they offer a fast and easy degree?
I don't think that's the way they would describe it, but I think what you have to do here is talk a little bit about the different types of colleges and different types of college students. In Johan's essay, he's very eloquent about why time matters if you're a traditional age undergraduate trying to learn to find your place in the world, explore different disciplines and so forth. And there, the idea that time is a good thing matters. Let's say you are a nurse with an associate degree. You've been out working as a nurse for 5 years and you think you know everything that a bachelor's degree nurse knows. Their competency may be a way for you to advance your skills, get a better job or promotion, or take on more responsibilities at work. These are two totally different situations. And likewise, you have students who have experiential-based education or internships or independent study. There are all kinds of positive things going on with some students at some colleges that don't fit into the traditional measures. That doesn't mean there aren't lots of students for whom seat time, which is a somewhat derisive term, really is talking about time to explore, which is a really good thing.
Alana Silva from the Foundation, it seems like the report is very pragmatic. Yeah, there's a lot of things that are going on. Some of these have great promise, but still we anchor a lot of where higher education and even K-12 ought to be with the Carnegie unit. Help us understand the landscape of these alternative metrics from the perspective of the Foundation. Just how promising are they, or in fact, are they just passing fads?
Sure. Well, in the report, we describe two major threads of reform. One is a push for more transparency in the system, and that's something, again, that we see throughout the system, K-12 and higher education, and in industry. Industry, too, is calling for that. They want to be able to see and know and understand clearly what students know and can do. And that's fair, and that's the right thing to do. We're very supportive of that and of the movement towards more transparency. The second thread is flexibility, that we're seeing a tremendous move towards more flexible designs and delivery models. And again, that spans the system. That too makes a lot of sense. We are in a different time, and we are able to access learning in very different ways. The internet itself just exploded that for us, and we're not going to go backwards in time. So we're comfortable and supportive of many of the programs and innovations and institutions out there that are trying to develop more flexible designs and delivery models. But in both cases, both in developing more transparent measures and in developing more flexible designs, there is a lot to be cautious of. And so the piece, I guess pragmatic probably is a good word. The piece tries to be supportive of those general ideas and the principles, but also be wary of what it would mean if we suddenly moved in one direction or another. And certainly if we were to get rid of, which is what many folks have called for, to eliminate a very central element of our system, and one that really does play a huge role in maintaining a system that we're proud of, that we think is, you know, a massive system of a diverse number and scope of institutions. We would want to maintain that. In order to do that, you need something to hold it all together. And the fact is that the Carnegie unit has played that role and seems like it will continue to. We're not defending the Carnegie unit to its death. I mean, as a couple of you said, of course there may be other measures. There could be certainly other formulas or calculations of time. But it does continue to play a role as an idea and as a tool, and we want to make that clear to the field.
So, Johan Neem, as we look at the landscape, it's a matter of coexistence, perhaps even detente, given some of the passion of advocates for alternative metrics?
Well, I think that's a false dichotomy. I don't know that alternative metrics are in any way opposed to the Carnegie unit or the credit hour. I think Alana was very clear, and I think she's right, that we're measuring different things with those two frameworks. And I think that to the extent that we assess student work, whether through grades, whether through exhibitions, whether through competencies, that's important, and that's a separate conversation. I do think, going back to your statement about the changing student body, I find that, you know, as a professor, I've taught some of the best 18-year-olds academically prepared coming out of high schools in America. I've taught returning vets, and I've taught returning adults. And one of the things I've discovered about all three sets of students, regardless, is it takes several years for them to master the kind of work that we would expect for them. So I think that while it may be true that a practicing nurse may have some of the competencies to get a bachelor's degree in nursing, that doesn't mean that that same person has had the kind of intellectual experiences we associate with a general education in the arts and sciences, which is part of a college education for anybody. And So I do think that we still have to think about whether you are young or old, rich or poor, if you want to get a college education, you deserve one. And I don't think it's something that only 18-year-olds deserve. I think all of us, even, you know, all of us go back through life at different moments and deserve the chance to engage in intellectual exploration that may be transformative for us. That's not a you know, an adolescent thing alone.
So, Scott Jasek, in the larger context of things, and conscious of your earlier comment about the ACE report, the American College on Education report about accreditation, is the conversation about change in the Carnegie unit one of kind of interest in the landscapes changing, or is there an urgency?
I think there will be more urgency for two reasons. One, there are alternate forms of higher education that do feel held back by the unit, whether that may be an unfair perception, but it's certainly a perception. And two, there is a desire for more information on what students are learning, what they know. Now, you can, as several have noted here this morning, you can do more to show student learning without killing the Carnegie unit. And so the challenge, I think, for higher education is to figure out, okay, if the Carnegie unit does some things but not other things, are there better ways for us to do the other things so that people know that a 120-credit bachelor's degree does mean something?
Great. Alana Silver from the Carnegie Foundation, Johan Neem from Western Washington University, and Scott Jasek, thank you for the conversation about the current state and future prospects for the Carnegie unit. In our second segment today, we will discuss a day without adjuncts. Data from the National Center for Education Statistics reveal that adjunct or part-time faculty now constitute fully half of the working professoriate in American colleges and universities, up from 22% in 1970, a third in 1991, and 45% in 2001. Moreover, while the number of full-time faculty increased 23% between 2001 and 2011, the number of part-time or adjuncts exploded, rising by 53% during the same period. The dire academic labor market of the past several decades has made it a buyer's market for institutions across all sectors who hire part-timers primarily because of cost and convenience issues. They are easy to hire and easy to terminate, typically do not receive benefits such as health care and pension contributions, and on a per-cost basis are far less expensive than their full-time counterparts, even those in the most junior ranks. Not surprisingly, adjuncts are not content with the low pay, high course loads, and dismal long-term job prospects. Many are also gypsies, teaching classes at two or three colleges each term. To highlight the dire working conditions and dismal job prospects, many adjuncts are considering a walkout on February 25th as a national protest. First proposed in October on social media by an adjunct at San Jose State University who wishes to remain anonymous because of concerns for job security, the concept of a day without adjuncts has excited some and been a cause for concern among others. Joining us for this conversation are Keith Holler, adjunct faculty at Green River Community College in Washington State and the founder of the Washington Part-Time Faculty Association, Alan Trevithick, adjunct faculty at Fordham University, Westchester Community College and LaGuardia Community College, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Let me add that both Keith and Alan have written extensively about the situation of adjuncts. Keith, let me begin with you. Would a national walkout benefit adjuncts? We'll stipulate that adjuncts are, as many believe, invisible to the larger world and are often exploited in terms of how they're compensated for courses. But again, would a walkout really provide benefits in terms of recognition of issues for adjuncts?
I think it's a great idea. Short term, I think it's already called attention to our plight, concentrating on the fact that we don't have job security. Many of us don't have sick leave. We don't have professional leave. We don't have any way to walk out without jeopardizing our jobs. However, there's a lot of things that people can still do in order to celebrate this day, and I think it will call attention to us around the country.
Alan Trevithick from Fordham and Westchester and LaGuardia, would a national walkout advance the situation of adjunct faculty?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I completely agree with Keith and everything he said, and I also want to emphasize one particular thing he said, which is there are lots of ways to participate in this, either outright walking out or in other ways making yourself visible. So, indeed, I think it's a really welcome development, and the visibility thing is extraordinarily important, not just for administrations and policymakers and so forth, but for each other. We need to become visible to one another.
Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed. This, you know, given that the person who first suggested this prefers to remain anonymous because of risk issues and concern about job security, doesn't the walkout pose a potential risk for those who participate?
Absolutely. I mean, first, let's think about the concept, a day without adjuncts. If everyone who's an adjunct walked out, the reality is there are an awful lot of colleges and universities where most teaching wouldn't take place. The national averages in some ways mask the fact that there are institutions that are overwhelmingly dependent on adjuncts. So this could have a huge force. At the same time, there are adjuncts who face collective bargaining rules, limits on strikes, who aren't necessarily connected to others who can support them. And there's a looming threat for every adjunct, which is for most of them don't have multiple year contracts, and so will you get hired back next semester? There's real risk for adjuncts who are visible. We've written about lots of cases where they've been punished for speaking out.
So
can I suggest some ways?
Please, Keith?
Can I suggest some ways we can reduce the risk? We're professionals. We're supposed to have control of our time, and we're supposed to have academic freedom, even if we don't have tenure. And therefore, we could make adjuncts a topic of discussion for in class. We could make out-of-class assignments, whereby we're in our offices, but our students are doing an assignment we've given them. I could easily imagine, given our working conditions, that there might be a national adjunct flu going around, and it might be that many people are sick that day. And then finally, people might be able to take leave without pay. So I think this is doable, and people are going to have to decide individually what level of risk they're willing to take.
Alan Trevicek, although obviously the intent of the walkout would be to gain support for the situation of adjuncts, isn't there also a risk about animosity or apathy? I mean, for a large part of the general public off campus, why would they care? And isn't there also the risk that many on campus, in state capitals and elsewhere, would be antagonistic to the walkout?
Well, about the first risk of apathy, how could we risk any more of that than we already face? The main problem is making this exploitation, which is what I call it and what Keith calls it as well, visible. If we do encounter some antagonism along the way, I suppose I wouldn't be particularly surprised, but I wouldn't anticipate that would be the overwhelming response by any means. Every time I've been able to have a personal conversation with either a tenured faculty person or a tenured faculty person or a student or the parent of a student, and to explain the situation, this two-tier system that is really, I think, destroying higher education, I've gotten a sympathetic hearing, so I don't anticipate a tremendous amount of antagonism, well, certainly.
Certainly, I'm not surprised that you would get a positive response in a one-to-one conversation, but at the heart of this issue, Keith Hohler, isn't this really about money? In terms of the fact that adjuncts cost a lot less to the institutions, they provide more flexibility for campuses that have to hire or not hire on the basis of what enrollments look like on a short-term basis. Where, Keith, for example, in the work that you do in Washington, where do you expect the state and where do you expect the community colleges and the four-year institutions to get the money to provide the adequate compensation and benefits for adjuncts? How's that going to happen?
Well, as I'm sure you've heard, President Obama has already suggested free community college tuition, and he's proposing that the states and the federal government come up with the money. So if they come up with money for free tuition, they ought to be able to come up with the money to pay us equally to the tenure-track faculty. This is really a major public issue because I think what we've got in higher ed is a caste system, not a merit system. And therefore, we have really over a million contingent faculty nationwide who are excluded from the tenure track and all that that means. And what that means often is that just because someone is on the tenure track, they have first crack at classes. They have first crack crack at research money, et cetera, on down the line, and highly qualified, sometimes even more qualified adjuncts and contingent faculty are excluded. We don't allow this with women anymore, excluding them, or with blacks. So it's time to have a merit system again in higher ed. It shouldn't be equal opportunity simply for students. It ought to be equal opportunity for the professors, too.
Alan Trevithick, what's the day after strategy?
I really would like to add something to that, which is I completely agree with what Keith just said, but also I don't think this is about money. And I think that the constant reference to shortages and financial difficulties is really very unhelpful. This is a 40-year trend in good times and bad about the adjunctification of the faculty to the point that we are now. So this is a problem that originated a long time ago, unless you want to suggest that for 40 years we've been suffering financially. I just don't think it works very well. But it is something that gets put about on all sides of this question at the political level and in very influential places like the American Council on Education, where you can hear this sort of rhetoric from Terry Hartle and others all the time. And I simply think that it does not help clarify the actual issue. The actual issue, as Keith puts it, it's a kind of apartheid system, to use a phrase that he's used that's often been sometimes controversial. We don't allow these things in other domains, and why should we?
Scott Jasek, to Alan's point, is it about money, or is it about other things, or is it about both?
I'd say it's about both. When I talk to administrators, there's no doubt that they are aware that they save money by using adjuncts. Now, they spend money on top lots of other things, so Alan's point is taken that they have money to spend on things that they want to spend on. But it's also about job security. It's about all kinds of rights. And it's about the ability of students to interact with faculty members who have full academic freedom and know that they're going to be back from one semester to another. To me, the interesting thing to watch on this day is, does it get enough attention to shake things up? Because as both of our guests have suggested, this system has been around for a long time. And so the question is, what will it take to shake things up?
So as we close, let me give Alan and Keith an opportunity. What happens the day after? Say the walkout is successful and large numbers of adjuncts don't show up, or say only a small number decide not to be in class that day. What's the morning after strategy? What's the morning after conversation on February 26th? Keith Holler?
Well, I think whether a national adjunct walkout day fizzles or whether it sizzles is up to the courage of adjuncts throughout the country. I'm hopeful that it'll sizzle, and I'm hopeful that it will leave a mark. I think we long-term are going to need some long-term strategy, some long-term organizations. We are involved in the civil rights movement. That didn't happen without strategy and without leaders. So I think we need that. But I'm happy that this is a grassroots organization, and that's taking off. It's an idea that came out of the blue, and I'm hopeful that it'll be successful. And we certainly have got lots of ideas to build on it later.
Alan, day after, what happens on February 26th?
Well, I feel rather the way Keith does, and I hope that no matter how many people show up, we will be able to recognize and meet with one another and think about some new forms of organization, particularly across different universities and colleges and in different sectors, private, public. I think that's an area that, for instance, the traditional faculty unions have not been particularly good at. And so I think that no matter what kind of showing we get, we're going to have a lot of organizing and discussion opportunities available to us afterwards.
And Scott Jasek is a journalist, is the official observer. What will you be looking for on February 25th, the day of the walkout, and on the morning after, on February 26th, after the walkout?
Well, on the day of the walkout, we're looking to see how many people participate and what it does. I view this as very much a long-term thing. There are lots of new strategies being tried. There's a big union push. There's lots of appeals to different groups, one-on-one conversations. We're looking at what how colleges are responding, how adjuncts are responding, how people entering the profession are describing. So while the walkout may be a big success, I don't expect a revolution the next day. I think this is going to be a long-term issue to watch.
Great. Our thanks to Keith Hohler, adjunct faculty at Green River Community College in Washington State, and Alan Trebethick, adjunct faculty at Fordham University, Westchester Community College, and LaGuardia Community College. Thanks as well to Scott Jasek for the energized conversation about the possibility of a day without adjuncts. Also, our thanks to Elena Silva from the Carnegie Foundation and Johan Neem from Western Washington University for the discussion about the future of the Carnegie Unit. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.